and he had a place in the world. He was a somebody. Take the inverse of that, and it was how I felt about myself. This feeling didn't seem like it derived from something I could fix or improve. It was simply who I was compared to who Jimmy was, which put my life in negative relief. But it would not have comforted me to date someone who was worse off than I was. Right after I moved to L.A., I ran into a guy from San Francisco, a guitar player who dated a girl I knew and had been in a band that everyone thought was cool. He told me 15 horror stories about his relapses into heroin and his roommate overdosing and his brother overdosing too, and something about someone named Noodles, a girl who had tried to pin the roommate's death on him, claiming he was at fault for supplying the drugs, and how finally now he was putting his life together, how glad he was to be out of San Francisco, we should hang out, etc. He had tattoos I didn't remember from when I'd known him, monster faces up his arms. They seemed like gargoyles meant to ward off bad energy, except he was radiating it, and I wanted to get away from him as quickly as possible. The apartment I'd sublet was near Echo Park Lake, on a curving street of collapsing Victorians just above downtown. It belonged to a girl I knew from San Francisco, a stripper who was away in Alaska, working up there at the gentlemen's clubs. Lots of girls would go to Alaska to make money, but they never came home with much. They made a lot at the clubs, but life was so dull and confining that everyone drank all the time, and the drinks were expensive, like everything there was expensive. Girls returned with an experience of Alaska and no money saved. This girl had a nice apartment because at home in L.A. she made great money at the clubs in the San Fernando Valley. They had a reputation and, as I discovered, it held up. Discovered, that is, after a rocky start at clubs in Hollywood that were just havens for tourists, couples who were there to gawk and had no intention of paying for a lap dance. There is nothing worse than when people your own age come along and jeer. It's always better to deal exclusively with customers who know the rules and play by them. The ones who are looking for the game, pretending there are girls in rhinestones and canary yellow stilettos who truly get off on drowning the faces of middle-aged men with their breasts. The customers we want are those who believe that the girls choose the rhinestones and stilettos because they are the type to wear them and not because they are merely pretending that type exists. Once I found the right places to work, I was cleaning up. But in terms of exact figures, keep in mind that every service worker paid in tips, whether they are a bartender or waiter or stripper, exaggerates what they make. It seems to be human nature. People don't outright lie. They take their very best day ever, their most outstandingly lucrative shift, historically, and they tell you it is what they average. Everyone does this. So I can tell you how much I made on a Friday night in the Valley, as if it were a typical shift, but I'm quoting my best Friday of all time, which was not typical. The lunch shifts, what I was given when I started, were not great money. Men came for the all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet and not for company. I sat in the back of the theater, bored, trying not to smell the sweet and sour pork as I listened to David Lee Roth say, "All you gotta do is jump." He designed his own clothes for the video, another stripper told me about 6 times. It seemed to be the only fact she had on hand or knew. Jackson's school was a block away from the sublet, so I could walk him there in the morning. And if I was working, my new neighbors, a large family with 4 children who all attended the same school, would pick him up and watch him for me. Quickly he was transforming from Jackson into Güero, which was what they called him. The grandmother was from Mexico and ironed every article of the entire family's clothing, including socks and underwear. They were loving people who probably didn't quite understand what I was about, but children involved no judgment or need to understand. I did not see any doom in the road. I was at least away from Kurt Kennedy, and Jackson seemed happy. I witnessed doom, though. It was around me. But at that time, I thought the bad luck of other people reaffirmed that I was doing okay. Take the plumber. This girl I was subletting from had a plumber who was always coming around. He was from Guatemala and really friendly. Too friendly. He had a lot of plans for me. Do you like it when your plumber has a lot of plans for you socially? He made it seem like he and the girl whose place it was had been good buddies, and so he expected the same from me. I was trying to start a new life, and this plumber kept calling me to talk about how one Saturday he was going to take me to Home Depot so I could pick out my own sink console, which the landlord was supposed to pay to install. And I said, "I don't care. Just bring one over. I'm a subletter, Victor." That was the plumber's name. "What does it matter?" But Victor said, as if out of consideration for me and for what I really wanted, "Whenever people do that, beware." "No, no, we'll go together. I'll take you. It's no problem, really." It was a problem to me because I didn't want to spend my Saturday with Victor. He showed up on the agreed day wearing a shiny patterned shirt and soaked in cologne. So much cologne, he seemed to be tapped into the original fount, the place from which it all flows. I dropped Jackson off with the Martinez family, and the grandmother, whom Jackson was starting to call Abuela, looked at Victor and nodded, like she understood everything. Victor and I went to get the sink, and the hours doing that were lost for me, because I didn't want to be in his van. I didn't want to be subjected to his happiness, which seemed to be based on nothing, a thin layer of good cheer stretched over emptiness. I missed Jackson. I missed Jimmy. I wanted a life I did not have, but I also was not ready to admit that. I wanted to get rid of Victor so I could drink beer on my porch as the ice cream truck broadcast its warped and moronic tinkle, and Jackson and the neighbor kids all lined up for type 2 diabetes. It was good to be a stranger in Los Angeles. It was bad to be a stranger in Los Angeles with the company of another stranger in a loud shirt. If everything were so great for this Victor, why was he wasting his Saturday blindly ignoring the blunt and unwelcoming cues from a woman who had no interest in him? I felt desperate, but not in the way Victor was desperate. After unloading the sink at my apartment, he tried to get me to go drink flaming margaritas with him at a Mexican place on Sunset. I said, "Those give me a headache. They use butane to make them burn," I told him, although that's probably not true. And he says we can have white wine, figuring I was that classy white wine type. Because I'm a nice person, I lied and said I had to work, although I was not working that whole weekend. I was planning to spend a lot of time thinking, sitting on the edge of this gone-to-Alaska girl's bed with my chin in my palm, hearing the ice cream truck, sitting with a blank mind, which might fill later, with thoughts on how to live like an adult. I was busy with that. It was important to me. No one bothering me, watching me, harassing me, calling me, following me, sneaking up on me. I'd had that for months with Creep Kennedy, and now I was free and did not want this Victor shading in. When he heard the lie that I had to work, Victor wanted to take me salsa dancing after I got off. I said no, and after several rounds of his pushiness, I finally got rid of him. A week later, Victor called me and said, "Romy, are you okay?" "I'm fine," I said. What business was it of his whether I was okay or not? "I had this terrible dream about you." Whenever anyone dreams about you, the dream tells you about them, not about you. It's their own private fantasy life, and they give it away by announcing who they dreamed about. But Victor was superstitious and was convinced that he should be worried about me on account of his dream. Victor died in a car crash shortly after that phone call, in the van we'd taken to Home Depot to get the sink. He'd had the bad dream about the wrong person. Shortly after Victor died, a neighbor, a young guy named Conrad, overdosed. I knew Conrad was a junkie. He sometimes helped Victor as an assistant, but it was charity on Victor's part. Every day, Conrad's sister came to our street and stood before the wrecked pile across from my place, where Conrad and his spooky mother lived. Every morning, the sister called her brother's name for the whole neighborhood to hear. Conrad's mother, Clemence, had knocked on my door when I first moved in to tell me not to order any pizzas. I looked at her and she said, "You know those black vinyl containers the delivery boys carry? The pizza warmers? They bring in evil. You see those warmers, and evil is on the way in." After her pizza box warning, she started talking about J. Edgar Hoover and Jimi Hendrix and all the other well-known individuals who had passed through the neighborhood and to whom her family was connected. She was vague and ominous about her super-heavy connections, these well-known individuals. "Okay, lady." I excused myself and went inside. I rarely saw her and didn't see Conrad much either, but every day I heard Conrad's sister call his name. Every day she stood on the sidewalk and yelled it. Then one day she did not, because Conrad had apparently died the night before. No more Conrad. Still, it did not occur to me that the street was cursed, although I did feel a start, a kind of shiver, when I saw a delivery boy get out of his car with a huge black pizza warmer in his hands. Not long after both Conrad and Victor died, I was at home, busy doing nothing until it was 3 p.m. and time to pick up Jackson, when I heard the neighbor next door screaming something over and over. It took me a moment to realize the word he was screaming was my name. I went out to see what he wanted. He was standing on the sidewalk with a towel wrapped around his hand, and the towel was raining blood all over the sidewalk. "You have to take me to the hospital," he said. When I first arrived, these neighbors had tried to be friendly to me, but I kept my distance. They were hard to look at. Shaved eyebrows, sallow skin, dyed black hair, black painted fingernails, a vintage black hearse. Victor did some plumbing work over there and said they kept a baby coffin in the kitchen for their canned foods. They had just bought their building, a fourplex, and were systematically evicting the tenants in order to raise the rent. They were goth slumlords. Two of their tenants had cleared out, but the family in the third unit was not moving. These tenants had nowhere to go. The husband was a diabetic and had just undergone a foot amputation. He was on crutches and insisted on driving himself to the hospital, and his leg got infected and had to be amputated higher up, at the knee. The wife worked cleaning houses and had asthma and no sense of smell from the toxic products her employers forced her to use. They were poor people without documents from Mexico with three children. I knew all this because a few days before the goth neighbor was screaming my name with his hand in a bloody towel, the woman he was trying to evict asked if she could speak to me. I let her in. She sat on my couch and cried and told me about her family and their situation. She said the landlord was trying to evict her and her husband for being alcoholics. "We are Seventh-day Adventists," the woman said. "We do not drink." I felt so bad for this woman that I looked up a tenants' rights organization and helped her set up an appointment to speak to an advocate. She left and thanked me, and I didn't feel any better. Her husband was missing a leg. She had to live underneath these landlords who, she said, made unchristian sounds in the night. The goth landlord was screaming my name because he'd seen my car on the street. He needed help and knew I was home. He had sheared off two fingers and a thumb with his own table saw. He had the severed parts in a garbage bag. I drove him to Kaiser Hospital in Hollywood, the Burger King of healthcare, running my horn through intersections along Sunset Boulevard as the guy bled on the seats in my car, which was a drag because that was a nice car. My Impala. I was stuck with him in the emergency room until his girlfriend could get there from her job. They had him shirtless and tubed with IV pain medication. I was forced to look at his tattoo, a chest-sized, upside-down cross. "Got this to spite my brother," he said, his words thick from pain medication. "He's a minister." "You sure showed him," I did not say. Victor dead, Conrad dead, the goth neighbor with half a hand. His tenants facing misery, amputation, deportation, the streets. Bad luck was all around me, although my neighbor and his table saw, that was more like karma. But maybe the worst omen was the veteran, all in black, like a grackle, a shadow that crossed my path in the form of a man. I had taken my car to the shop to have the radiator rotted. The auto shop I went to was off Glendale, and it was an easy bus ride home. The bus I wanted was the 92. I was waiting when this man strolled up, Vietnam tattooed vertically up his neck. Black felt hat, black clothes, black shoes with no socks, little tinted sunglasses, stylish in an unwholesome way. I was a POW, he said to me, showing me his home-inked hand, POW. There are two planes of time, the time of waiting for the bus and the time when the bus finally pops into view. I was in the wrong plane of time and stuck with a crazy. Soft heat and exhaust blasted my bare legs as cars accelerated up the hill. They cut the head off my penis, the POW said. Don't tell me about that. I apologize, he said. Hey, could you spare anything? I handed him a dollar because there was still no sign of the bus and I wanted him to move away. He took the dollar, opened his wallet, but before putting the bill in, he turned the wallet around so that I would not see what other bills he had in there. It's always this way. Crazy people only lose their cunning last, if they ever lose it. The bus arrived. I sat in the back. The ghost of my childhood lives in the back of buses. It says, "What's up?" juts its chin. The POW sat in the handicap seats up front, struck up a conversation, bothered someone else. He got off at the Arco farther down Glendale, where heroin is bought and sold. I was watching him out the window. I craned my neck to see if he was scoring dope. But what gave me the goddamned right to take note of what he did and where he went? You can't own someone for a dollar. Thanks to Jimmy the Beard and his idea of a practical joke, Kurt Kennedy drove his motorcycle all the way to Los Angeles, parked it between two cars. He waited on my porch behind a thick screen of bougainvillea so that he was invisible from the street. That morning, a Sunday, it was 90 degrees when I got up. Jackson and I went to the beach with Jimmy Darling. I'd never been to the Venice Boardwalk, and perhaps taking me there was Jimmy Darling's own idea of a practical joke. We strolled along past the sword swallowers and tattoo parlors and piercing salons, the tables with pineapple incense, blueberry incense, and melon oil, mango and strawberry hookahs. Crunk and old-school hip-hop blared as hippies danced recklessly, swinging their waist-length beards and beads. Homeless senior citizens slept in pools of urine. Shirtless rollerbladers, fake-baked and sweaty, weaved among the crowds and the indiscreet piles of vomit. People shoved. Children cried. "This is awful," I said. Jimmy Darling put his arm around me and said that he liked to think of it as the very best California had to offer. We walked over to the skateboard park because Jackson wanted to watch the teenagers riding around in its concrete pools. When we got there, an argument was erupting between two skateboarders. One cracked the other over the head with his board. People came out of nowhere, and suddenly there was a crowd of shirtless men fighting. Jimmy picked up Jackson and ran. I followed them. We found our car and got in it and sat. I was upset. That crack, bored to skull. Jimmy calmed me down. We took Jackson into a bar away from the beach, ate hamburgers, and watched a Dodgers game. After the game, as we said goodbye, it felt like I had someone I could rely on. We kissed through the window of Jimmy's truck until I pulled away and said goodbye. I drove home. Jackson fell asleep in the back seat. It was probably 9 p.m. when I parked on my street. I know it was 9 p.m. because every minute was later accounted for. I mounted my stairs, carrying my slumped little boy over my shoulder. On my porch, in my porch chair, sat Kurt Kennedy. Kennedy, with his dented and bald head, the square freckles, the neck roll, the hoarse voice, the persistence. Here he was. To have moved away and felt free of him for the first time in months, and to come home and find him waiting for me. I had the bad luck, too. Chapter 19. Candy Pena made baby blankets with the yarn Gordon Hauser had brought her. The blankets were collected by a unit officer and placed in the office of receiving and release. Whenever Gordon passed the office, he saw them there, in a giant leaf bag, the colors of the yarn that he had chosen peeking out, garish and sad. One day he asked the officer in R&R about their status. The officer was a scalded blonde with a tight ponytail, brusque, ex-military. She snorted. "These? Nobody wants them. I keep forgetting to tell the porters to take them out to the trash." That same officer supervised family visits when inmates got 36 hours in the prison's version of an apartment with blood relatives. Blood relatives. It sounded so violent. Or was Gordon losing perspective? Everything warped by what was around him. "Was it difficult to watch them say goodbye?" Gordon had asked the R&R officer before he knew better. He had witnessed passing family visiting, small children clinging to their mothers and crying hysterically. Someone had painted a lavender hopscotch pattern on the walkway outside the family units. "You grow a thick skin," the officer said, her mouth pulled into a frown as if to demonstrate, "This is thick skin. Especially when you know it's the mother's own fault." It would have been better if the baby blankets had gone to the trash. Instead, one of the unit cops had redistributed them to the women on death row who had made them. When Gordon was next back there, Candy Pena had patched together her two baby blankets into a large vest, a sort of poncho in soft, gauzy blue and yellow. She held it up. "I hope it fits." Knit was the past tense of knit, and no one wanted what Candy Pena knit, not even Gordon, who put the vest in a paper bag deep in the trunk of his car and tried to forget about it. He let whiskey pad his brain at Baresi's one night and was overcome by nostalgia for Simone, the woman he'd dated in Berkeley. Recently, she had called and left a message, wondering if he'd plugged in his refrigerator. That had been her joke when they'd dated, meant to imply that he was a work in progress, not yet ready, but eventually headed for, life with a plugged-in refrigerator. It was a way of equating his lack of domestic instincts with his rejection of her, which made him guiltier than she knew, because it wasn't quite right. It was Simone he'd had reservations about, not parting ways with bachelorhood. He had not called back, and why not? Now that he was drunkish and lonely, he could not think of the reason. The young bartender, with her big smile, her fake breasts pressing against the buttons of her shirt, kept asking the assembled but separate drinkers, all male, if they needed anything. "Y'all have everything y'all need?" She asked it like this was Appalachia and not the Central Valley. On the TV above her was handheld footage of a city taken over by a Shiite militia, men and boys in white face masks ripping past the camera on motor scooters, piles of debris burning casually in the background. Someone asked the bartender to put on Minor League Baseball. Gordon would read about the militia when he got home. The war was private. It was between each man and his computer. Gordon might have opted for a more ascetic life and skipped getting DSL, but the previous tenant already had it installed. The landlord said he was one of the lucky ones. Many addresses on the mountain could not get service. "I'll send Simone a postcard," he thought. Be oblique. Not disclose that he hoped to make her cry out like that puma on his mountain in the scene he imagined. Simone, having come down to his cabin in the woods, his books in little stacks along the dirty floor, his bottle of whiskey on the kitchen counter, a woman there to witness his solitary life, his acquired taste for valley beauty. To the untrained eye, not beautiful. The valley was a brutal, flat, machined landscape with a strange lemonade light, thick with drifting topsoil and other pollutants from farm equipment and oil refineries. It was a man-made hell on earth, but then again a real valley, with mountain ranges on either side. It was the size of industrial agriculture, scaled for that. It was difficult to imagine what it had looked like before it was farmed. It was hard even to imagine what it had looked like farmed in the old-fashioned way, by people. Machines shook the almond trees in synchronous violence. Their fruit fell to the ground with every mechanical jolt. Other machines swept the unhulled almonds into furrows, and yet other automated contraptions sucked the almonds up chutes and into hoppers. That all happened very quickly, once a year, the September harvest. Most of the time, the huge parcels of almond orchard were empty and quiet. He paid his tab and walked to the gas station next door. The gas station was the main booze outlet in town, and there was a line, men and boys squinting under the harsh lights as they waited to buy their malt liquor and Mad Dog. Gordon retrieved a small Perrier from the refrigerator cases for the trip up the mountain. The carbonation helped him stay alert while driving. The kid in line behind him gazed at Gordon's drink as he set it on the counter. "What is that?" he asked. The green, pear-shaped glass bottle looked suddenly comely and exotic. Gordon understood the kid had mistaken it for something alcoholic. "It's, this French water." "French water?" the kid tisked. "I thought it was some new kind of drink." They had no postcards at the gas station. "Try the Dollar Tree," the cashier suggested. He found no postcards of Stanville. Apparently, it wasn't a place you commemorated, and if he wanted to be in touch with Simone, he could just send her an email like a normal person. That Christmas, his week off, he drove up to Berkeley to sleep on Alex's couch. "How's your one-room life?" Alex asked. Gordon did not contact Simone. He and Alex made the nostalgia circuit, the used bookstores, the Irish cafeteria in the flats, the coffee houses on Telegraph that were filled with good-looking women who worked hard at appearing effortless and natural, the barbecue place on Shattuck and the Blues Club next door, which could have had a sign when they were in college, "Smokiest Tavern on Earth," but no one smoked in bars now. It was illegal. Alex and Gordon talked about the war. They both checked the same websites obsessively, informed comment for analysis, and eye casualties for metrics. Found the same things funny and the same things heinous. It was all heinous, but some of it was funny. The way Bush talked about Mr. Maliki, whom the CIA had installed as president. "I'm trying to help the man," Bush said with real but clueless desperation at a failed press conference. "Trying to help the man," Alex kept repeating. Just after Christmas, the new Iraqi government hung Saddam Hussein. Gordon and Alex watched it on the internet. "He was pretty dignified," Alex said. "He was being heckled as he died, and yet I feel he got the last word." Gordon went over the bridge to San Francisco alone, ate at a Vietnamese restaurant downtown that his student Romy Hall had told him about. Not that she was recommending it to him. She listed it among places she missed. The cook, she'd said, had this funny habit. After he uses them, he bangs his cooking tongs twice and tugs on his shirt. His smock has a big grease splotch where he does that. And his father sits chain-smoking and chopping meat upstairs where the bathrooms are. The cook was there on Gordon's visit. He banged the tongs twice and pulled on his shirt. The father was upstairs, chain-smoking and chopping a huge pile of meat. On New Year's, he and Alex went to a party in Oakland, a typical situation of people jammed in a kitchen and asking pointless questions like, "What do you do?" and "Where are you from?" The women paid extra attention to Gordon, not knowing already what the problem was with him, as they had already established with the other single men at the party, according to Alex. Some of them were former grad students who'd branched off from the English or rhetoric or comp lit departments into psychoanalysis, not just undergoing it, but putting out a shingle. Alex said that he'd been labeled a male hysteric, which mostly meant the women who blithely diagnosed him wanted to sleep with him but found him too wily and little brotherish for an actual relationship. When Gordon hesitantly mentioned what he did for work, after being asked several times, the women in the kitchen were on him like a plague of locusts. Really? A prison? That must be hard. Prison guards. I wouldn't be able to look at those people. They don't even wear their own clothes. Like cops, but even worse. What a fucked up life. Much discussion among the women about the scum of the earth who worked as guards. He did not have the courage, or maybe it was the will, to ask if these women had ever known a prison guard. And why would he defend prison guards? He hated them himself. But if a person got outside their own bubble, they would see that prison guards were poor people without reasonable options. One had just blown his head off in a guard tower at Salinas Valley. He could have told them this, engaged in corrective arguments with these women at the party. But wasn't it obvious? Didn't even wear their own clothes. The interaction brought back anxieties from grad school, the way his peers could casually criticize others they didn't know anything about. As the first and only member of his family to pursue so-called higher education, maybe Gordon was prone to hypersensitivity. He had encountered people in graduate school who were eager to declare working-class pedigree, and they maybe had one parent with less education, or the family had been poor but college-educated. Either way, if someone was insisting loudly on their own authentic origin, this was generally taken by Gordon as evidence that they weren't actually working class. If they were from a background like Gordon's, they would know to hide it the way Gordon did, because the fact of his pioneering status was itself proof of just how tenuous his escape was. Some people he knew showed up at the party, friends from the department who had gotten postdocs and talked about their upcoming job interviews, the details of their academic book contracts, as if these were interesting subjects. The women were doing that grad school thing of air-quoting to install distance between themselves and the words they chose, these bookish women with an awkwardness he used to find cute. Gordon did not want to discuss his life with these people. He drank as a temporary salve for his alienation. He and Alex woke up with hangovers. With Alex, at least, Gordon could express something of what it was like at Stanville. He had been describing his students, giving Alex the impression that Romy Hall was just one more student he helped, or tried to help, equal with the others, which made him inwardly aware that it wasn't the case. Alex started questioning him about his involvement with prisoners. Alex talked about Norman Mailer and Jack Henry Abbott. Alex said he wondered whether Mailer was responsible for what happened after he got Jack Henry Abbott, his little pet project, out of prison. He wasn't a pet project, Gordon said. Yeah, Alex said. He wasn't. He was a person. But did Norman Mailer understand that? His first day back at work, the warden put the prison on lockdown because of fog. It wasn't even real fog. It was haze from the crop dusters that sprayed the almond fields surrounding the prison. Lockdown meant everyone confined to their cells, no work exchange, no classes, no movement. He would be paid to do nothing, like everyone at the facility, but he felt a sense of regret. He would not see her, would not tell her he'd gone to her Vietnamese place on 6th Street. He went home and let impulse drive his actions, called the number she had given him. Jackson Hall was the name of the kid, written on a pink piece of paper. I am just inquiring. She doesn't even have to know I made this call. The person who answered told him to dial another number. At the new number, he was put on hold for a very long time, and then passed to someone's voicemail. After several days, someone called him back and left a message. Gordon was at work. He called the number the next morning, reached a voicemail, and left another message. This went on for weeks because Gordon wasn't home much since he worked down in the valley and lived up on the mountain. What he eventually learned when he spoke with a human being at San Francisco's Family and Children's Services was exactly proof of why he should not have gotten involved. Chapter 20. A few years ago, some fuckers built a vacation house just across Stemple Pass Road. Motorcycle and snowmobile fiends. They would buzz up and down the road past my cabin most weekends, summer and winter. Last summer they were worse than usual, sometimes made it a 3-day weekend. It was getting absolutely intolerable. My heart was going bad. Any emotional stress, anger above all, makes it beat irregularly. It got so that the constant cycle noise was choking me with anger, heart going wild. Risky to commit crimes so close to home, but I figured if I didn't get these guys, the anger would literally kill me. So one night in fall, I sneaked over there, though they were home, and stole their chainsaw, buried it in the swamp. A couple of weeks later, I chopped my way into their house, smashed up interior pretty thoroughly. It was a real luxury place. They also had a mobile home there. I broke into that, too. Found a silver-painted motorcycle inside. Smashed it up with my axe. They had 4 snowmobiles sitting outside. I thoroughly smashed engines of those. A week or so later, cops came up here and asked had I seen anyone fooling around any buildings. Also asked if I had any problems with motorcycles. The truth crossed their minds. But probably they didn't seriously suspect me. Otherwise, their questions would not have been so perfunctory. I'm pleased I was so collected in answering cops' questions. Chapter 21. This is how a guy never, ever wants to wake up. Handcuffed and in a hospital bed. But that was how Doc found himself. Cuffed to the bed. A doctor walked in. Not a prison medical technician's assistant, but a real doctor. He was even wearing a white coat. The doctor leaned over him. "You're awake," he said. "Can you hear me okay?" Doc nodded. "Do you know how you got here?" Doc shook his head. He had no goddamned idea. "Okay, that's okay. Let's start with basics. Do you know what year it is?" "It's..." Doc did not know what year it was, but it dawned on him that he knew how to answer this stupid question. "It's the year after last year." The doctor frowned. "Do you know where you are?" Doc looked around, saw nothing but a metal cart with pills in paper cups, an armed guard sitting on a chair. The room had no windows and there was nothing on the walls. He looked down at his body. Saw a garment that was half a garment. His hand was plastered with tape holding a needle in. Tubes ran from his hand up to a metal stand with a bag hanging from it, half full of clear liquid. A person who must have been a nurse came in and eyed the bag, squeezed it in a way that seemed reckless and walked out of the room. Doc's cuffed wrists were chained to the bed's metal rails. His ankles, too, were manacled to the bed rails. He had no clue where he was. All he knew was that his skull felt like it had been split in half by a concrete spillway. Icy water splashed through the spillway, pushing his brains apart. "Any sense of where you are?" the doctor asked again. "Yes. I am directly above the center of the earth." "Hey, at least it was an answer." The doctor smirked. "All right, funny guy. And can you tell me your name?" "I can," Doc said. "I know my name. I know it." "Congratulations," the guard called out from his chair. "It's Richard L. Richards. See this?" Doc glanced at his own forearm, where he had a big dollar sign tattooed, and underneath it, "Fuck you, I'm rich." It was a joke. He was rich. Rich Richards, even if people called him Doc. He'd discovered it on the wall of a tattoo parlor in Hollywood, among the designs customers could choose. Doc didn't have amnesia. He knew who he was. "Fuck you, I'm rich." He just got his bell rung somehow and could not remember the sum or how. He had a shackle around his waist. A stun shackle, actually. If he tried to pull away, it would zap him good and fierce. "What did I do?" he asked the doctor. "Did I kill somebody?" The armed guard at the door laughed long and loud. "Did I kill somebody?" he imitated in a mock-high voice. "You sustained a traumatic brain injury," the doctor explained. "You almost died. You've been in an induced coma for 8 weeks now, while we waited for the swelling to go down." Has this asshole been sitting there guarding me the whole time? Time and a half, actually, the asshole said. The doctor explained to Doc that he was in a hospital in Lodi. Fuck, I hate Lodi. But had he ever been to Lodi? He wasn't sure. Traumatic brain injury, they kept repeating at him. The doctor gave him a pamphlet, educating your loved ones about your TBI. It was what they gave out at that hospital, which did not treat convicts unless it was forced to. Doc didn't have any loved ones, but he read it anyway. He would be sleeping a lot, his imaginary loved ones were meant to understand. He might seem to have undergone a personality transformation and present now as more mild or more angry, less or more prone to violent outburst, gifted in a savant-like way, or blunted and dulled in intelligence and executive functioning. Loved ones, for those who had them, should be patient about these changes and about the recovering person's confusions and sensitivities, his vertigo, his atypical ideas and erratic moods. Doc did have a lot of strange thoughts over the days he lay in that bed, waiting for the nurse to come in and squeeze and change the IV bag. Mostly they were thoughts about country music stars who roamed his mind like ponies on a circle track. These stars, men and women both, were fancy, dressed to perform for thousands on stage and many thousands more in television land. They were folks who seemed like old friends of the family, but he didn't know what family or whose. There was a reunion feeling crowding into his mind, many people gathering on the stage for an all-star number. Dolly Parton with her dimples, Roy Acuff, Ray Pillow, Ray Price the Cherokee Cowboy, Skeeter Davis, Ferlin Husky, everyone in on Wildwood Flower. Cut to a commercial by Martha White Flower, sung by Flat and Scruggs. The doctor said that brain injuries could do that. Make you see a memory clearly, or hear music, or in this case, both. Doc's sadistic foster dad, Vic, had been fond of the Grand Ole Opry and watched the TV show. Porter Wagner was his foster father's favorite. Porter Wagner wore denim jackets with cutaway tails to showcase his frypan-sized rodeo buckle. His face was tall and oval-shaped, like the canvas opening on a covered wagon. His slack creases could have sliced ham, slacks that were too form-fitting to need any belt, much less a rodeo buckle. And the idea that a dandy like Porter Wagner had been a winner or even a contestant in any legitimate rodeo was not realistic, but it was part of the culture. Time pedaled past, Doc's thoughts free-floating, giving the days and nights a seamless sameness, dazed wakefulness, a fresh IV bag, an exchange of lighthearted hostility with a guard by the door, and knockout sleeps. One day they put him in prison clothes and shuttled him back to New Folsom, but not his former block. Doc had to go to the skilled nursing facility because he slept 20 hours a day and had balance issues, fell over when he tried to walk. He knew what year it was. He knew where he was. He could not remember why he hated Lodi. But maybe it wasn't important. Fuck you, I'm rich. The information was back, more or less, but he felt changed, altered. Not just on account of the country music piping in through one ear or via some other entry point, piping in and filling him with sounds and images from the past. The most extreme difference was his temperament. It was like someone had gone in there, into his head, not the biological goo packed into the skull, but the real him, the memories and feelings, the images stored up. As if someone had gone in there and mucked around, changed things, while he was in the coma. He felt different. He felt good. Even if he suffered from debilitating headaches and did not always have words when he went to say them, he had this feeling that everything was going to be okay. Which was strange, because nothing would be. He was serving a life sentence without parole. And he was a cop, and now that well-guarded secret was out. Everyone knew, which was why his cellie had tried to kill him. Doc was green-lighted. His future would only be shitty. He would be transferred to a prison that was all protective custody. Once there, if his cover got blown, If people found out about his background, there would be no place left to transfer. It was likely Doc was going to die a violent death. And yet, he took things 1 hour at a time and didn't panic. He felt a sense of peace, and it was new, a new feeling for him. Probably his edge had been blunted, just like the pamphlet for his imaginary loved ones had warned. "I feel good. I feel pretty fucking good," he said to the blank walls of his little cell. "What did they dose you with, honey?" a voice from the next cell called out. "I want some. All they give me is Ultram." "I don't get any drugs," Doc said. "I just feel good. It's 'cause I got my brains bashed in. What happened to you?" "I was jumped, and the cops watched. No one helped me." His neighbor had a high voice. Doc liked the sound of it. He had overheard the nurses. His neighbor was a powder puff, a she. Her name was Serenity, and Doc wanted to know all about her. "Are you white or black?" he called through the wall. "I'm all colors, honey." But he saw, through the slim window in his cell door, when they took Serenity to the showers, that she was black. She was thin and delicate-boned and had the face of an angel. A fucking angel. He saw it. Chick was good-looking. But the poor thing. Her arm was in a sling and her leg was in a cast. They rolled her down the hall in a wheelchair. The way she smiled when she turned back to her nursing attendant amazed Doc. She had a woman's smile, and something about her smile, it made the world worth smiling over. He tried to get a glimpse of her every time he heard the commotion of her cell being opened. "Hey, all colors," he said one morning. "I think you're beautiful." "You're not my type, love." "How do you know?" 'Cause I seen you. Your head looks like a softball with all that stitching." Doc laughed. "I seen you, too. They really messed you up, didn't they?" They had beat her unconscious. She cried as she told him about it. Later, when Doc thought back on what Serenity told him, he knew he wasn't completely changed now. He knew he was still the old Doc, because he could stoke his own anger by thinking about what had happened to Serenity. He wanted to obliterate the two people who'd hurt her, put bullets in their skulls, put their bodies in his trunk, and eject them into the dumping ground of desert between L.A. and Vegas. He was growing fond of the voice next door, the girl next door. He used to insult the powder puffs, and why? These were ladies in a men's joint. He had enjoyed their boobies, but he didn't treat them like humans. Serenity was pretty close to a genuine lady. She had no pecker. There was nothing down there. She made fun of him for saying it that way, but in the presence of a woman, he didn't want to talk crude. She'd had a sex change, but it was prison cell surgery, performed on herself in a moment of bravery and desperation. She almost died from blood loss. She got better. They put her in general population. She was attacked, raped, and beaten by two men in her unit. The prison wanted to keep her permanently in ADSEG. "They said they can't guarantee my safety. Even if they put me in a snitch prison, I might not be safe." She was petitioning to get reclassified as a female and sent to a women's prison. There was another inmate in the state system who had done this, her lawyer told her. It was Serenity's dream. "I hope your dream comes true for you," Doc called to her through the wall. Soon, Doc himself was going to snitch prison, but he did not tell Serenity this, or really anything personal. What was there to say? I was a crooked cop who murdered people? His eggs might have been scrambled. He might be weak and softer than before, but he wasn't stupid. Over those months in the skilled nursing facility, when he wasn't yelling back and forth with Serenity, he listened to the country music that was more or less playing all the time. There was a finger on a button in his brain, pressing play. He heard Grandpa Jones, Booger Beasley, the Possum Hunters, the Fruit Jar Drinkers, the Tar Paper Sharecroppers, String Bean and his string band. String Bean was a singer who wore pants belted at the thigh, way down low, attached to his shirt so the whole ensemble would stay up. It was funny back then, in the 1960s. At least his foster father Vic thought it was funny and wanted Doc to laugh alongside. Or Vic wanted Doc to go fetch him an ashtray. Stringbean was tall, but his pants were tiny because belted down low at his thighs and much shorter than a tall man's actual legs. Stringbean was not making fun of the way young black males had their pants so low down. It was way before all of that. If you told Stringbean that his pants were gangster style, and also prison style, belted at the thigh, well, you just wouldn't. There would be no way to explain it. The comedy show on the Grand Ole Opry was for white people. Country music was for white people, even when it was sung by Charlie Pride. Stringbean's low-slung pants were a freakish accidental echo. Hillbilly bands sang jingles for Hillbilly Flower, which was a brand, Hillbilly. Little Texas Daisy Rhodes sang the ad with the Golden West Cowboys. She had bad skin and dark eyes and a grainy, lurid appeal. Not pretty, but pretty sexy. Hank Williams was malnourished and his spine was crooked. Minnie Pearl had been cleaning rooms as a maid when Judge Hay gave her the big break at the old maid age of 28. Hank Snow had been a cabin boy. Marty Robbins was raised in a tent, caught wild horses for a living. Porter Wagner had a third-grade education. Dolly Parton had a dozen siblings and no indoor plumbing. Country music was a homey affair, and not the homey of people who wore low pants like Stringbean, but not as a joke, not the homey they meant, which was another word for brother or friend. Texas Ruby Owens burned up in a trailer fire. A trailer fire was a hazard for many sorts of people, Doc's people, but also the types of people Doc arrested. Doc had shown up on the scene of a trailer fire in Westlake in the early 1980s. It was a slovenly place vandalized by its own inhabitants, Mexicans who mixed their beer with clam and tomato juice, lit superstition candles and passed out, forgot about the candles and one fell over. "Party shack," Doc had said after the firemen had doused the flames and the trailer was just a charred shell, hissing and steaming. Doc had thought it was funny these people had burned themselves homeless. Fuck, I was such an asshole. He told Serenity he had been a bad person. He'd hooked up with another bad person, and they killed a guy together. He told the whole story to Serenity of Betty and her husband's hitman. Serenity said if the dude was a hitman, maybe they'd done a good thing. Maybe Doc wasn't all bad. Serenity was a flirt. She sugarcoated, probably part of why he liked her so much. "I killed a kid for no reason," he said, switching to the worst fact, the scene outside the pawn shop on Beverly. Blew his brains out. "I killed someone too," Serenity said, to Doc's surprise and irritation. This was his big confessional moment, and it turned out they were both assholes. And suddenly Doc wanted to have a pissing contest, insist he was worse. But then he remembered Serenity was a lady and not to compete. He tried to focus on what she was saying. "My cousin Sean had this stupid idea to steal some shit from a house," she said. "No one was supposed to be there. They were just some people with jobs, and they were supposed to be at work, but they were home. Sean went off the plan and tied them up, but the man got loose and escaped. All we had was the woman, and she was screaming her head off. Sean ordered me to shoot her. I did what he said. I'd give anything to bring that lady back." Serenity got her reclassification. The state considered her female. After that, everything went fast. They had to whisk her out of the prison because they suddenly had a woman deep in the nursing ward of a men's facility. Doc felt all her excitement and nerves through the wall. He congratulated her and wished her luck. "I'm scared," she told him. "What if the women don't accept me?" Doc told her what Judge Hay had said to Minnie Pearl when she was just starting out, green as the hills of Tennessee, and nervous to go on out there on the big-time stage at the Grand Ole Opry, in front of so many people. "You gotta just go out there and love 'em, honey," Judge Hay had said to Minnie Pearl, and Doc repeated to Serenity. "Just go out there and love them, and they'll love you right back." 6 weeks later, Doc's counselor told him he was well enough for a medical yard on a sensitive needs block at a snitch prison in the high desert. I cannot fucking wait, Doc said, with not the slightest trace of sarcasm. Chapter 22. I got a visitor one day. You don't know beforehand who it is. They call your name and send you to visiting. I had been at Stanville 3.5 years, and no one had ever come to see me. I didn't even get mail. I had written to a few friends from San Francisco. None of them wrote back. People fall away quickly when you disappear into prison. I couldn't imagine who had made the trip. When I got through strip out, I saw that it was Johnson's lawyer. I don't have news for you, he said, in response to my look of hopeful surprise. I came to see how you are. The thing about retirement is, you don't retire from thinking. From here, I'm going up to Corcoran to visit a guy who got 5 life sentences, and another who is life without. You look healthy. I'm not, I said. I'm just tan. I had been spending so much time on the unshaded yard that my arms and legs were the cake brown color of unglazed donuts. Teardrop was also in the visiting room. She was sitting with an old man. The guy was sweating profusely. He looked about 95. I didn't know people that old could sweat. Teardrop was 6 feet tall, strong, semi-masculine, angry, and beautiful. Her hair pulled back tight, face like a weapon. This old man was stooped and bald and kept clutching his chest. It was obvious he was a runner she'd hustled through the mail. At a different table was Button Sanchez, also with an old man. He'd bought her an entire smorgasbord from the vending machines, microwave hamburger and french fries, ice cream sandwich, and 2 kinds of energy drink. She was smiling at him as he fondled her breasts with his eyes. Teardrop and Button and other women around me, all working their keiths. It was not that different from the Mars room, except here they were preening and selling their asses for prepackaged junk food, or, in Teardrop's case, a bag of heroin. I needed runners like the rest of them. I, too, now had a page on a pen pal site. But what could be gotten this way had no real value. Did not lead to peace of mind, to help for Jackson. It led to nothing but animal existence with mail-order cologne, 2 choices, taboo or sand and sable. Is there any way to contact my son? That's outside my area. If I could help you with that, I would, but I can't. I have to get out of this place. I watched the old man slip Teardrop a package and Teardrop shove it deftly into her prison pants. You've got to help me. The lawyer opened his briefcase and took out a stack of papers. I'm getting rid of records and thought you might want your file. It's the material from your case. Depositions, notes, witness interviews, discovery. Seeing that stack of paper, the record of what happened, to me, I was overcome. I yelled at him to keep from crying. I said I'd been doing research and was pretty sure he'd given ineffective counsel. Oh, dear, he said. That would be such a waste of your energies. Why? Because it'll make you look bad? Because it doesn't work. Even in these unbelievable cases, where the lawyer is totally out to lunch, they still side with him. One guy fell asleep during cross-examination of his client. Another was a felon himself, handling a murder case as community service, but had no experience as a trial lawyer. Think those guys were ineffective? Not according to the Supreme Court. You got a very tough deal. There's no question, and I feel for you. If only I could have afforded a lawyer. He shook his head. Romy, the people who hire private lawyers but can't afford a good one, I mean an expensive one, oh boy, is that painful. You should see the private attorneys people end up with. Guys who do DUIs suddenly handling a capital case. It should be illegal. You were much better off with the public defender's office. It was hard to imagine I could be any worse off, and I said so. Tears ran down my neck. I wanted to unload on this man, and yet he was the only person who had ever come to see me. Teardrop's visitor collapsed on the table. The cops from the cop shop rushed over,